Chapter 126. Stay often at the grand new house, whither Mrs. Osborne was going, and where Mary was sure she would never be so happy as she had been in their humble cot, as Miss Clapp called it, in the language of the novels which she loved. Let us hope she was wrong in her judgment. Poor Emmy's days of happiness had been very few in that humble cot. A gloomy fate had oppressed her there. She never liked to come back to the house after she had left it, or to face the landlady who had tyrannized over her, when ill-humored and unpaid, or when pleased had treated her with a coarse familiarity scarcely less odious. Her servility and fulsome compliments, when Emmy was in prosperity, were not more to that lady's liking. She cast about notes of admiration all over the new house, extolling every article of furniture or ornament. She fingered Mrs. Osborne's dresses, and calculated their price. Nothing could be too good for that sweet lady, she vowed and protested. But in the vulgar sycophant who now paid court to her, Emmy always remembered the coarse tyrant who had made her miserable many a time, to whom she had been forced to put up petitions for time, when the rent was overdue, who cried out at her extravagance, if she bought delicacies for her ailing mother or father, who had seen her humble and trampled upon her. Nobody ever heard of these griefs, which had been part of our poor little woman's lot in life. She kept them secret from her father, whose improvidence was the cause of much of her misery. As he had to bear all the blame of his misdoings, and indeed was so utterly gentle and humble as to be made by nature for a victim. I hope she is not to suffer much more of that hard usage. And, as in all griefs there is said to be some consolation, I may mention that poor Mary, when left at her friend's departure in a hysterical condition, was placed under the medical treatment of the young fellow from the surgery, under whose care she rallied after a short period. Emmy, when she went away from Brompton, endowed Mary with every article of furniture that the house contained, only taking away her pictures, the two pictures over the bed, and her piano, that little old piano which had now passed into a plaintive jingling old age, but which she loved for reasons of her own. She was a child when first she played on it, and her parents gave it her. It had been given to her again since, as the reader may remember, when her father's house was gone to ruin, and the instrument was recovered out of the wreck. Major Dobbin was exceedingly pleased when, as he was superintending the arrangements of Joe's new house, which the Major insisted should be very handsome and comfortable, the cart arrived from Brompton, bringing the trunks and bandboxes of the emigrants from that village, and with them the old piano. Amelia would have it up in her sitting room, a neat little apartment on the second floor, adjoining her father's chamber, and where the old gentleman sat commonly of evenings. When the men appeared then bearing this old music box, and Amelia gave orders that it should be placed in the chamber aforesaid, Dobbin was quite elated. "I'm glad you've kept it," he said in a very sentimental manner. "Was afraid you didn't care about it." "I value it more than anything I have in the world," said Amelia. "Do you, Amelia?" cried the Major. The fact was, as he had bought it himself, though he never said anything about it, it never entered into his head to suppose that Emmy should think anybody else was the purchaser, and as a matter of course he fancied that she knew the gift came from him. "Oh, you, Amelia?" he said. And the question, the great question of all, was trembling on his lips, when Emmy replied, "Can I do otherwise? Did not he give it me?" "I did not know," said poor old Dob, and his countenance fell. Emmy did not note the circumstance at the time, nor take immediate heed of the very dismal expression which honest Dobbin's countenance assumed, but she thought of it afterwards. And then it struck her, with inexpressible pain and mortification too, that it was William who was the giver of the piano, and not George, as she had fancied. It was not George's gift, the only one which she had received from her lover, as she thought the thing she had cherished beyond all others her dearest relic and prize. She had spoken to it about George, played his favorite airs upon it, sat for long evening hours, touching, to the best of her simple art, melancholy harmonies on the keys, and weeping over them in silence. It was not George's relic. It was valueless now. The next time that old Sedley asked her to play, she said it was shockingly out of tune, that as he had a headache, that she couldn't play. Then, according to her custom, she rebuked herself for her pettishness and ingratitude, and determined to make a reparation to honest William for the slight as he had not expressed to him, but had felt for his piano. A few days afterwards, as they were seated in the drawing room, where Jose had fallen asleep with great comfort after dinner, Amelia said with rather a faltering voice to Major Dobbin, "I have to beg your pardon for something." "About what?" said he. About that little square piano. I never thanked you for it, when you gave it me, many, many years ago, before I was married. I thought somebody else had given it. Thank you, William." She held out her hand, but the poor little woman's heart was bleeding, and as for her eyes, of course they were at their work. But William could hold no more. "Amelia, Amelia," he said, "I did buy it for you. I loved you then as I do now. I must tell you. I think I loved you from the first minute that I saw you, when George brought me to your house, to show me the Amelia whom he was engaged to. You were but a girl, in white, with large ringlets. You came down singing, do you remember? And we went to Vauxhall. Since then I have thought of but one woman in the world, and that was you. I think there is no hour in the day has passed for 12 years that I haven't thought of you. I came to tell you this before I went to India, but you did not care, and I hadn't the heart to speak. You did not care whether I stayed or went. I was very ungrateful," Amelia said. "No, only indifferent," Dobbin continued desperately. I have nothing to make a woman to be otherwise. I know what you are feeling now. You are hurt in your heart at the discovery about the piano, and that it came from me, and not from George. I forgot, or I should never have spoken of it so. It is for me to ask your pardon for being a fool for a moment, and thinking that years of constancy and devotion might have pleaded with you. It is you who are cruel now," Amelia said with some spirit. "George is my husband, here and in heaven. How could I love any other but him? I am his now as when you first saw me, dear William. It was he who told me how good and generous you were, and who taught me to love you as a brother. Have you not been everything to me and my boy? Our dearest, truest, kindest friend and protector? Had you come a few months sooner, perhaps you might have spared me that dreadful parting. Oh, it nearly killed me, William, but you didn't come, though I wished and prayed for you to come, and they took him too away from me. Isn't he a noble boy, William? Be his friend still, and mine." And here her voice broke, and she hid her face on his shoulder. The Major folded his arms round her, holding her to him, as if she was a child, and kissed her head. "Will not change, dear Amelia," he said. "Ask for no more than your love. I think I would not have it otherwise. Only let me stay near you, and see you often." "Yes, often," Amelia said. And so William was at liberty to look, and long as the poor boy at school who has no money may sigh after the contents of the tart woman's tray. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.